This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
We're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
Welcome to False Flag Weekly News. It's 20th May, 2016, and I'm sitting here about 40 miles north of the Montana border in Alberta, Canada, and I'm looking at Gerard O'Coleman. Hello, Gerard. Gerard is in front of the Arc de Triomphe in Paris, France, and Gerard is the host of he's a co-host this week. Kevin Barrett is on his way to New York for the Left Forum. And tomorrow there will be much broadcasting on No Lies Radio of the Left Forum. And Gerard O'Coleman and Kevin Barrett, Dr. Barrett, will be among the presenters, as will Jim Fetzer. And this is kind of a breakthrough for these false flag stories for 9/11 particularly, where the left is kind of closed itself off from these type of stories. Tomorrow, Kevin Barrett will address Noam Chomsky, who's demeaning of the 9/11 truth movement, who's insulting dismissal of it, has had an enormous consequence. So, Gerard, welcome to False Flag Weekly News. This week, we're co-hosts, and you're filling in for Kevin Barrett. How's it seem in Paris, France right now?
Well, as you can see, it's a pretty nice sunny day behind me here. All is fine. One is privileged to be in Paris and not in Damascus, and not have to live in Tripoli, in Libya, or Afghanistan, or Somalia, or any of the other countries being attacked by the people who own most of property behind me. So I'm outside the Napoleon Hotel, which is a famous hotel in Paris near the Arc de Triomphe. And life goes on. One, as I say, one is generally genuinely privileged to live here and not in the places attacked by the people who own this place. So I'm very happy to be here this week to discuss a few topics with you.
Yeah, and I'm sure many people will know who you are, but a few might not. So I became aware of your work, Gerard, in December when I met you. Well, actually, it was just after Friday the 13th, November the 13th, the false flag attacks in Paris. And within hours of that event, Gerard, you did an interview with Russia Today, a 12-minute interview, which really went viral. And I was among, you know, the hundreds of thousands of people who was really struck by the clarity of your analysis. You introduced many subjects, including the weaponization of the victims of globalization, the migrants who were flooding into Paris and to the rest of Europe and into Germany. You introduced many subjects there. I got to meet you shortly thereafter when at No Lies Radio we did False Flag Islamophobia, and we spent the day in Versailles, and I got to know that you, for instance, speak six languages, including your mother tongue, Celtic. Irish Celtic. So
it's not my mother tongue, but it's the national language of Ireland. It's the official language of Ireland. But I'm not a native speaker. I didn't grow up speaking it. But it is one of the two official languages So I've been an Irish language activist for many years, and people who speak it, there are some native speakers, I'm not among them, but fluent speakers of Irish are Irish language activists, like I write in Irish as well. So it's a sort of a community. We believe in defending indigenous rights and defending linguistic rights and minority languages. And Irish is one of the oldest languages in Europe.
This is a really important perspective in Europe right now, that indigenous peoples, you know, we usually apply the term indigenous peoples, for instance, to the people in the Americas, the native people in the Americas. But Europe is a home of many indigenous peoples, including the Irish. And, of course, there is a movement to assert the importance of heritage and tradition and self-determination of peoples in Europe. So we can talk about that. The first story I'd like to go to, I'm calling it, is the 9/11 scam coming undone. And, of course, 9/11 is kind of the classic subject here, because it's the classic false flag terror event, and it really changed the psychological milieu that we live in and the geopolitical milieu that we live in. And it seems that in this season something is really coming undone. It might have something to do with the elections and the fact that Donald Trump, for instance, has been talking in and around the subject. Of course, presidential candidates sort of avoid this subject, but it's been coming up. There's the 28 pages that this congressional committee investigating in 2002 that has been suppressed, and what will happen to that. There's just been a recent law that you can sue Saudi, that victims' families can sue Saudi Arabia, which is referred to in these 28 pages. And, of course, beneath this is the fact that we pretty well have an idea who did 9/11, and Saudi Arabia was involved, but the deeper state, the deeper issues go back to the Zion American Empire and to Likudnik Israel. And, of course, so these issues are emerging, and the first specific story, I'm calling it Torture, the 9/11 Culprits and the Ongoing Destruction of State Evidence. It comes out that this 6,700-page investigation of a Senate committee chaired by Dianne Feinstein into the details of the torture, illegal torture applied by the CIA in dark sites, that this, the CIA itself has lost this. The Inspector General of the CIA, the kind of policing mechanism within the CIA, has just mysteriously lost this document, which has not yet been made public. We have a 500-page executive summary that is public, but this evidence is being made to disappear. And, of course, interestingly, this whole investigation came about because of the disappearance of videotapes recording the torture of individuals. And, of course, these torture sessions were used as part of the evidence, so-called evidence, for the 9/11 Commission report, which is, you know, well known to be kind of a fraud, deception. Really, it's the Philip Zelikow report. So this phenomena of disappearing evidence, of course, you know, the steel remnants of the three twin towers were carted away, were taken away and not properly investigated, subject to forensic investigation. Evidence upon evidence upon evidence of what happened on 9/11 is being made to disappear, has been made to disappear. Are you following us at all, Gerard?
Yes. Yeah, well, I mean, I think just to comment on what you said there about disappearing evidence, about evidence being withheld, it's a common feature of our time when it comes to any kind of investigation of matters that concern foreign policy of Western governments. One of the stories we'll be going on to in a moment is the Ivory Coast, where massive amounts of evidence being withheld there. But I think that the Israeli role in 9/11 is really the key to understanding how it came about and why. And I guess something I've seen a lot more of in recent years, a lot more evidence of Israel's role in 9/11. And that sort of, that Israel tends to function as a kind of a deep state within the United States, that the deep state in the United States seems to be linked to this other state. And so that more and more Israel emerges as, or seems to appear, it appears as a kind of a shadow state in the United States. You have a lot of Israeli firsters in the United States, these, you know, Israeli firsters, these neocons, half of them, I think most of them, tend to be Israeli citizens or Jewish, or pro-Jewish, pro-Israel Jews. That's something that I think a lot of people have ignored, but it, to me it seems key to finding out who really was responsible and perhaps even also explaining how. Because one of the things that I don't understand is how they pulled it off. How could you pull off something of this scale?
Well,
so, the scale is so impressive, surely, so spectacular. The surely, level of organization involved.
A big essence of it was to blame Islam, to create a new enemy, to make the regional enemies of Israel, especially Palestinians who are Arabs, to sort of inflate that identity and make Islam, especially the Arab part of Islam, but the Persian part, the Malaysian part, the, you know, the Islamic world, to demonize it. And in the next story here, which is the, where I got the title, or I invented the title, is the 9/11 scam coming undone? We actually now are in the trial of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. And so he is kind of the archetypal Islamic terrorist. He's the so-called mastermind of 9/11. Now, whether or not this person presented in this picture is actually Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, that's doubtful. It was reported in Asia Times that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was killed by Pakistani authorities back in 2002. But in any case, the government of the United States has been holding since 2006 in Guantanamo this individual, and there was going to be a trial in New York, and that was put off. That was going to be the 10th anniversary of 9/11. And finally, there's a trial underway at Guantanamo Bay. It's not really a trial. It's a military process, a secret process. And lo and behold, here's another case of the destruction of evidence. It turns out that the judge and the prosecutor had conspired together to destroy evidence before the trial without informing, he actually has lawyers, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed or the person being presented as such. So here's yet another case of the destruction of evidence. And so this, case has become a kind of debacle. This trial has become a kind of debacle.
Yeah, I mean, it's another example, I suppose, of the criminalization of the state. You know, the fact that, you know, judges are taking orders from the government. You're supposed to have separation of powers between the executive and the judiciary, and yet you see this kind of connivance. You know, you see this kind of conniving behavior between the judiciary and the executive and the government and so on. That's a big problem. Of course, it kind of proves Marx's theory of, you know, sort of ruling class representing ruling ideas. All being based in a kind of dialectical relationship with the economical structure which drives it. In other words, the rich protect themselves, and, you know, ultimately what you get is a kind of a very tightly knit group of people who are capable of kind of keeping a lid on things. It's certainly the case in the United States, and it's certainly the case here. I mean, the case we'll talk about, the Ivory Coast, in a moment, is an example of that.
Let's get into that subject presently. But I would mention the judge Alvin Halberstein. Alvin Halberstein, who sort of kept a lid on the case in New York. Not allowed families to sue the proper parties, like, for instance, the security, Israeli security company, ICTS, for instance, that was handling security at Boston, so-called security at Boston, when this false flag event was concocted on 9/11. So we have now the military trial of the so-called mastermind of 9/11, and let's move along to the next story on 9/11, and we're headed towards Côte d'Ivoire, which I'm very excited to hear your perspectives on, because I think you've done original research in exposing a false flag in the Ivory Coast in Africa. And it's on record that the French government actually did this attack and blamed it on Al-Qaeda because it wants to intervene militarily. And you've got the goods, you've got the stuff on it. But let's go to the slide number 4 as we just move through 9/11 here, the classic. And I just want to draw attention to an article in Pravda. Interestingly, in Pravda, which, of course, when I was young, Pravda was the sort of example of a controlled media, of a propaganda media. Pravda in Russia has interviewed Kevin Ryan. And there's just a phrase here that I think is worthy of consideration. Ryan says in this interview, with 9/11, it's past time to recognize that religion had nothing to do with it and foreigners could not have made it happen. Well, of course, 9/11 has a great deal to do with religion. I mean, when we talk about Israel, we're talking about an entity that calls itself the Jewish state. And, of course, the whole psychological operation was created to demonize Muslims, especially jihadists, especially, you know, Al-Qaeda and such. And so, you know, it's permeating with sort of religious fables. And so why is...
They should call it the Talmudic state. They should call themselves the Talmudic state because that's what it is. It's an utterly hateful fascist entity that just, and that's what Talmudism is. I mean, from what I've read of the Talmud, I've read enough to conclude that it's not very nice towards its enemies. Certainly, it's quite a hateful sect of, if you can call it that, of Judaism. I agree with you absolutely. I mean, the Israeli ideology has a religious component as well. I mean, it's a quasi-messianic ideology. The essence of Talmudism is the notion that those people calling themselves Jews have a claim to be the master race and are racially superior to everyone else and are going to rule over everyone else. I mean, the people are obviously mentally ill, but the problem is when a lot of mentally ill people get their hands on the levers of power, then that does become a problem. Usually mentally ill people are harmless, but these guys are quite harmful. So it is something that concerns everybody, and it is a very sick ideology, Zionism, particularly in its current form. I mean, you could make arguments about Zionism like in the 1950s, and there have been mutations and so on. I mean, it's definitely a lot worse now than it probably ever was. It's global pretensions and it's a desire to go for global domination.
So here we are 15 years later, and little by little the alternative investigation, the citizens investigation involving many, you know, top academics has gone forward on 9/11, and we the available evidence has been analyzed and points increasingly at Israel and at those within the United States whose primary allegiance is to Israel. And what happened in the 9/11 truth movement to sort of disempower us to some degree? And so, you know, there's Kevin Ryan who comes into the process as a employee of Underwriters Labs and, you know, is involved in the insurance process. If this steel frame structure failed to this degree, what was wrong with the steel? And Ryan comes into to play as a sort of professional involved in this and says nothing was wrong with the steal. It couldn't have, the steal couldn't have failed in the way that NIST and others are saying. And he makes this stand and has a lot of attention. But here in Pravda, in the Russian publication, here's Ryan saying, let's not talk about religion. Let's not look at all at religion, and let's foreigners could not have pulled this off. A code to say Israel could not have pulled this off. So the thing is, I find it interesting. This is in Pravda because you know this story that Gordon Duff says that Putin is going to expose the 9/11 psyop, the 9/11 attacks, and that Israel did it. You know, maybe Putin is more cooperating with Israel than we realize. So the fact that this story is in Pravda is significant to me.
Well, he says in that article.
And now you and I, a European and a Canadian, will discuss with Professor Fetzer the U.S. election. And, you know, there's been big developments, and I'm sure the big development is going to be that Trump is actually more popular than Hillary Clinton in popular polling, and this changes the dynamics a lot. Welcome, Jim, and take it away.
Well, thanks, Tony. It has been a rather fascinating week. As the first slide shows, as you are implying, we have the first poll showing Donald Trump in the lead over Hillary Clinton by 45-42, whereas last month she was leading by 48-41. I switched back and forth between Fox News and MSNBC, especially to get alternative perspectives on these issues. And I think that Bill O'Reilly had it right, namely that the bump for Trump is because his opponents have dropped out. We no longer have John Kasich and Ted Cruz competing for the vote, so many of their supporters are coming to Trump. How long this will endure is another matter. We already have a new poll out from CBS and the New York Times claiming that Hillary is in the lead of 47-41. But it has upset Hillary, and she has, I think, a bit gone off the rails, now giving interviews where she's attacking Trump as unqualified, and where she's making other mistakes on which I'm going to report today. The next story has to do with deception in the election itself and the primaries. I previously reported that I thought that the Democrats were committing as much electoral fraud, even more perhaps than the Republicans. We've had several states, including Illinois, where Sanders won the exit vote, but the state was given to Hillary, Ohio, where Sanders won the exit vote, but it was given to Hillary. Missouri, where Sanders won the exit vote, but it was given to Hillary. Now, Richard Charnin, who is a completely brilliant statistician who's published two books on the theft of elections using voting machines, has confirmed that the Kentucky primary, which Hillary won by a razor-thin edge, was clearly manipulated. She won by 2,000 votes out of 413,000 cast, 46.8-46.3, where Lundergan Grimes, the chief election officer for the state of Kentucky, told voters that electing Hillary Clinton was more important than doing her job. Card readers malfunctioned and were fully erased from Pike County, Kentucky. This gave Clinton the lead. At one point, all Pike County data represented all zeros in the vote total. Later, 20% of the total votes were missing, and Clinton regained the lead. This is quite striking because Pike County is a cold country, and there's no doubt that Hillary would have done very poorly in Pike County had it been legitimate. As Charnin also report, election fraud was found in 31 counties. There were at least 76 calls to the hotline of the Office of the Kentucky Attorney General, Andy Beshear. Complaints included procedure and legal questions, voter assistance issues with voting machines, voter identification, residency, election officials, in electioneering, poll disruption, and vote buying. I have no doubt at all that this was manipulated to benefit Hillary. It would have been just too embarrassing to lose both of those elections to Bernie Sanders, but legitimately Bernie would have won the day. Now, a fascinating development comes from the head of national intelligence, as the next slide shows, James Clapper, who's claiming that there are attempts at cyber hacking on the candidates' emails and correspondence, and that the National Security Agency wants to lend a hand protecting them. I have no doubt that this is a ruse. Hillary's greatest concern about Trump is that he's unpredictable. If they can have a cover for obtaining inside information about what Trump is going to do in advance, that will give Hillary an advantage in coping with it. I have no doubt whatsoever that given the administration's overwhelming bias in support of Hillary in order to extend the legacy of Barack Obama, that Clapper is taking this action not to benefit the security of the candidacy's communications, but to penetrate them and to inform Hillary Clinton so she doesn't fall behind. As a next story,
What are the chances? What are the polls showing? My sense is that the polls are showing that Sanders has a better chance of beating Trump than Hillary Clinton by a long shot. Is that an accurate reading of what's going on?
Oh, yeah, there are lots of poll results that show that, Tony. But the fact is that the DNC, led by Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and the creation of the super candidates and the way they're managing these elections is all intended to ensure that Hillary will be the nominee. So you have a lot of Sanders supporters believing the vote is rigged, and that even though Sanders shows himself to be a stronger candidate against Trump, about which I have no serious doubt, that nevertheless, all the effort is going to be made by the Democratic Party and by the Obama administration to coordinate Hillary, in spite of the fact that she's a seriously vulnerable candidate. As the next story shows, the emails are coming out now, and it shows, for example, that Hillary's support of the overthrow of Assad in Syria was to benefit Israel. It had nothing to do with Assad's purported abuse of the people of Syria, but rather of Hillary's ongoing efforts to benefit Israel, where, of course, as you were implying, 9/11 was orchestrated in order to reverse American foreign policy from one in which, at least officially, we did not attack any nation that had not attacked us first, to one in which we became an aggressor nation with a plan outlined by Wesley Clark, about which he had learned when he returned from serving as Supreme Commander Allied Forces Europe, Commanding General of NATO, in other words, to the Pentagon to take out 7 governments in the next 5 years, beginning with Iraq and Libya, ending with Syria and Iran. Russia's intervention has put a halt to that, but not for lack of trying. So that what we will have with Hillary is an ongoing perpetuation of endless wars in the Middle East, where both Sanders and Trump are opposed to that policy. Both are non-interventionists who do not believe in regime change and nation building, but rather in becoming involved militarily only when it's in the interest of the United States, which is a very, very different approach. It's quite fascinating, by the way, to discover that Loretta Lynch, who is the Attorney General, turns out to have a very odd history, where at Harvard she had a roommate by the name of Sharon Malone, who happens to be the wife of a former Attorney General Eric Holder, and where she has a lot of ties back to Hillary, to Holder, to the Obama administration, where she is going to do what she can to ensure Holder won't be prosecuted for Fast and Furious drug cartel standards, IRS scandals, VA scandals, and a whole host of others, where she's protecting the information that Obama has been using, the Social Security number stolen from Connecticut of Harrison J. Bunnell, 042-684425, which is bogus, and a host of other issues. So I think it's clear that Loretta is going to be holding the fort on behalf of Hillary, and may very well preclude that she be prosecuted even for the abuse of emails, where it's become overwhelmingly clear that she has violated all of the restrictions on the use of emails by this private server, for which we have a host of information, or even the Russians have 20,000 of these emails that they could very well release at any point in time, demonstrating her incompetence. So while she wants to... Go ahead.
There must be hundreds and hundreds of issues that criminality is just swimming around Hillary Clinton. You were very outspoken last week, Jim, going through just how much stuff is on record, how many laws she's broken, how she is a symbol of the fact that there is an elite group in the United States that is above the law, that don't have any consequences for breaking the law again and again and again.
Yep, you're right, Tony. Hillary's very vulnerable on multiple fronts. And now in response to this latest poll, she's announced that she's going to put her husband, Bill, in charge of the economy, which is a huge mistake on multiple grounds. The first, of course, means she loses the woman card, the idea that she could be the first woman president, because now she's calling for help from her husband. And of course, Barack Obama's also going to be campaigning for her. It makes Bill Clinton himself fair game. His economic policies are in retrospect calamitous, because he supported the North American Free Trade Agreement, which led to the gutting of the manufacturing and industrial base of the United States, and the deregulation of Wall Street, which led to the derivative scandals that would come to a head in the early 2000s. So I think that this is a great mistake. Not only that, but as the next slide shows, while there has been an attempt by the Clinton side to tarnish Donald Trump for his relationship with women, including a huge story in the New York Times, which at best could be interpreted as showing he sometimes acted in a caddish fashion, nothing rises to the level of Bill Clinton's improprieties in relation to women, where he was even thrown out of Oxford for raping a fellow student, and where the National Enquirer issue talks about 36 women who have broken their silence. They're not all complaining of sexual abuse by Bill. For example, one of the stories is about Hillary going berserk when Barbara Streisand stayed overnight in the White House and slept in the Lincoln bedroom. I think she was very confident knowing Bill's history that he was climbing into bed with her. There's no end of salacious attacks on Bill Clinton that are going to emerge now in rapid order, where Roger Stone has published a book entitled The Clinton's War on Women, that documents many of them, including, for example, that Chelsea Clinton was actually not fathered by Bill, but by Webster Hubbell, who was a senior partner in a law firm where Hillary was an attorney. I mean, this is sex in the workplace and a host of other issues. She's highly vulnerable. And we can go even further, because as the next slide shows, flight logs for what is known as the Lolita Express show that Bill Clinton was involved much more frequently, had something like 26 flights on the Lolita Express that was flown by a convicted sex offender. And this is going to come up again and again and again. So I think Hillary's just thrown away her strongest card, namely the claim that she was going to be the first woman president by compromising, bringing in Bill to throw her a lifeline, implying she can't do it on her own, and where Barack Obama's involvement is going to further compromise her strongest card. This is going to be the dirtiest campaign in American history, I have no doubt. And what she doesn't really...
Speaking of which, this Epstein sex scandal, with underage escorts servicing the likes of Bill Clinton. Alan Dershowitz, I think Gerard will be interested in this. Alan Dershowitz is one of the lawyers trying to protect Epstein and this group. That's a very sort of interesting development for the Harvard professor who is leads the charge so often, accusing people of various thought crimes for criticizing Israel.
Yeah, you're right. You're right, Tony. It is a fascinating aside. Here's just an indication of the political skills of Donald Trump, who has already announced 11 potential Supreme Court justices. This is significant because Donald's past history has been more oriented toward Democratic or liberal policies than conservative. So many have been worried about who he might appoint to the court. He's identified 11 over a large number of key states, and they're all extremely good from a conservative point of view. So he is doing a great many things to bring solidarity to the Republican Party, even meeting with Henry Kissinger, who many of us regard as one of the world's great war criminals, and making other gestures in an effort to bring together the party. Hillary, on the other hand, as the next slide suggests, is getting into deeper and deeper water, because here you have a financial analyst who's been studying the Clinton Foundation and found that there are many, many improprieties. Last week I reported that the several of the Arab countries, the United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, had contributed $100 million to Hillary that went to the Clinton Foundation. This is obvious bribe money being laundered, just as her speeches to Goldman Sachs and other Wall Street law firms for $225,000 a speech, leading Bernie Sanders to remark, those must be some speeches to deserve that kind of money, is another open form of bribery that gets the money into her coffers, into her pocket, in a way that is pulling the wool over the eyes of the American public.
Speaking of the American public, is there any chance, Gerard, that you could give a bit of an intervention on how the U.S. election is being perceived in Europe? And whether people there care about it. Obviously, the U.S. election affects people all over the world, although we don't have a vote in it.
Well, I think, just to be brief, I don't think I don't see anything good about any candidate. And I don't think any candidate is going to change the system. I think Trump is playing the role of Marine Le Pen in France. And he's doing a good job. He's doing a good job with that. He's appealing to a lot of marginalized people. But interestingly, if I had to choose, I mean, I have no faith in Trump, absolutely none. I mean, once he gets into power, I hope I'm wrong if he does get into power. But if I had to choose between Clinton and Trump, it would obviously be Trump, because he's got no blood in his hands. He hasn't committed the kind of crimes Clinton has committed. So it kind of makes me laugh when I hear people calling Trump a fascist, when it's clearly Hillary Clinton who is the psychopath and the maniac. The interesting thing about Trump is that he's deeply contradictory. He seems to be a master of contradiction and paradox and controversy. But if you look at what he said, you know, things he said about Sarkozy and the Libyan war, saying Sarkozy should be prosecuted for the Libyan war, and his position vis-a-vis Russia is a lot more progressive, I would say, than Hillary Clinton's position. He was against the Iraq war. He's obviously very critical. Now, his position on immigration, again, is ambiguous, but immigration is bad for the labor movement. That has always been the Marxist position. But ever since the Trotskyites took over and the Chomskyites and all that kind of crowd, the petty bourgeois leftists in the 1960s, from then on, the labor movement has been told by these university leftists that internationalism is all about open borders. It isn't. That was never the view of the traditional, of the theoreticians, if you like. Marxism never believed that. The Second International didn't hold that view. Marx didn't hold that view. Neither did Engels. So that's rubbish. Closed borders would actually be very good for the U.S. labor movement. It would enable them to actually organize in unions and to actually really gain social rights. It would be very bad for the ruling class. The ruling class are open borders. So the fact that he's he's saying, you know, that they need to kind of close up borders and reduce immigration. Well, that certainly, if he did implement it, it would be something that would be very good for the labor movement in the United States. It would be very good for the labor movement in Europe if we had something similar. I just don't believe that that's going to happen. But, you know, it's something that has destroyed the labor movement in the United States. Look at black workers, for example, who are majority in a lot of trades by the 1990s. Now it's Mexicans. Got more and more black people ending up in jail because they've got no jobs. They're being rejected by employers because they want cheaper Mexicans and so on. It's the same thing in the past with the Irish and the Italians and the Jews coming in. That displaced a lot of black workers as well in the United States. So I think that agenda of stopping immigration, of course, is an anti-globalization agenda, and he's defending that. But I don't think he's going to implement it because he serves the same interests, really, as the others. But what's interesting about Trump as a candidate is that fact that he's self-financing. You know, that he's got his own money, so he kind of says what he wants. But I doubt very much if he's going to change anything, you know. He's still, in terms of Israel, it would be nice to see a candidate who would finally break the hold of Israel over the United States. Trump has more annoyed the Israelis, but he's very much subservient to Israel, as we've seen in the APAC and so on.
Those observations, that commentary is more perceptive and intelligent than any you'll find from the American media. And some of your concerns are reinforced by the next story, which is that Sheldon Adelson, who is a prominent supporter of Israel, is calling the party Unify behind Trump and offering $100 million of his own to help finance, while Trump has been able to carry his own financial burden through the primaries. The general election in the United States is so enormously expensive that it demands resources from others than he himself, and Adelson is responding to that. The great concern being that because Adelson is so devoted to Israel that it may suggest that the Donald's attitude toward that country is unlikely to change very much. But Hillary is anything, if anything, an even greater zealot in support of Israel. Remember the email I just reported on about saying the reason to take out Assad in Syria was to benefit Israel. And indeed, she said from a nuclear Iran, when our own intel agencies, all 16, concluded as long ago as 2007 that Iran was not pursuing nuclear weapons. So that, you know, it seems to me the Iran deal was actually a very good move by Barack Obama for a non-existent problem, but at least smooth over relationships to a significant degree. Where I am troubled that the Donald doesn't seem to have a firmer handle on the Iran situation. The next slide is also rather stunning because it reveals that pro-Hillary PACs are spending millions of dollars to hire online trolls, principally to harass and to argue against Bernie Sanders supporters. So this is one of many ways in which Hillary has been resorting to cheating, lying, and stealing. We had in Arizona, for example, protesters of Trump who were paid as much as $3,500 to protest, and they were told if they were asked about it to declare that they were enthusiastic about Bernie Sanders. This was a Hillary move, which shows she's going to leave no stone unturned in order to secure the nomination for herself. Another issue where Bernie and Trump differ with Hillary has to do with Second Amendment. The death of Antonin Scalia has created an opportunity where even Chelsea has reported that her mom now thinks she can succeed in undermining the Second Amendment because of his death. There's a history of the United States of gun ownership, citizen soldiers, not only to protect against an invading force, but also against the tyranny of their own government. And I think because of the creation of 300 FEMA camps, Department of Homeland Security acquiring over 2 billion rounds of 40 caliber hollow point ammunition, and a host of other issues that concern that the government is attempting to turn the United States into a tyranny through the declaration of martial law, is at an all-time high. Another fascinating aspect of Hillary's move on gun control is her tie-ins with the families from Sandy Hook, where I and a dozen other collaborators have demonstrated in the book Nobody Died at Sandy Hook 2015, which Amazon promptly banned, that it was a two-day FEMA drill, that the school had been closed by 2008, that there were no children there, and it was done to promote gun control. Now, one of the recent confirmations that it was an elaborate hoax comes from a man by the name of David Wheeler, who is a sometime actor married to a woman by the name of Francine, where David, it has been determined, not only played the role of a grieving father, but of a SWAT team member marching up and down Dickinson Drive, holding a weapon upside down by the magazine. As a former series commander in the Marine Corps, where I had 15 drill instructors and 300 recruits under my command at the recruit depot in San Diego, I can tell you no one with any familiarity with weapons would ever act that way. So that's another massive hoax. But she and her husband were flown by Barack Obama to Washington, D.C. She was put on television from the White House to give a lengthy talk about gun control. Well, it turns out that Francine Wheeler was the personal assistant to Maureen White, who was the Democratic National Committee Finance Chair. In other words, it appears that the Democratic National Party was itself deeply involved in the Sandy Hook hoax. We already knew that Eric Holder had gone to Connecticut and met with the governor of Connecticut on the 27th of November before the event of 14 December 2012 to explain they were going to take an abandoned school, a conducted drill presented as a live event to promote gun control, and that Barack Obama was deeply involved. But here we have even more proof that it even extends to the Democratic National Committee, which I find all the more shocking. The next story shows that there's a concern about the abuse, the theft of these elections by Bernie Sanders. Mika Brzezinski, who is the daughter of Zbig, is one of the two hosts of the Morning Joe show with Joe Scarborough, and spoke out Wednesday morning to call for the resignation of Democratic National Committee Chairwoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz for unfair treatment of Bernie Sanders, not only by creating the mass of superdelegates that were to be used to guarantee that Hillary would get the nomination, but also by scheduling debates, very few debates with Bernie at odd times when they were unlikely to get any viewership, and where she has taken other actions that I believe may lead to a calamity in Philadelphia, as Robert Perry in the final slide reports. Perry is observing that we have a real conflict between the Bernie Sanders anti-war faction and the Hillary Clinton neocon foreign policy, where she wants to expand the U.S. war in Syria while continuing other wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Libya, and even challenging Russia on its borders. I believe that Perry is quite insightful in anticipating what's going to come, because while there has been a belief that the Republican parties were very divided, it's clear they're now becoming unified. The great splintering, the great faction, the great division of the Democratic Party, I predict an agreement with Robert Perry is going to take place at the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia. So stand by. This is turning out to be the most fascinating election campaign in American history.
Yeah, and this attack on the Democratic Party chair by the team of Bernie Sanders, I did notice that there was Wasserman Schultz, a direct hit on her, but then the campaign manager of Bernie Sanders suggested that Bernie Sanders was getting ready to fold into the Hillary Clinton campaign. And I think that would be so alienating for the young people who really took Bernie Sanders seriously, who want peace, who can't stand the way our governments have been going with the United States, you know, this idea that it's the leader of the free world. Well, what a mess we've been led into by the United States.
Tony,
interestingly, Bernie Alexander seems to be the one candidate who is willing to stand up to the Jewish lobby.
Yeah.
And this is the most serious questioning of the power of the Jewish lobby that we've seen at that level. So I think it would be disastrous if Bernie Sanders just goes along with the party establishment. He's got to find a way to not disappoint, to, you know, whether it be a third party candidacy, which might bring in Trump. The point you make is crucial, and we've got to play through that conflict within the United States.
Tony, your observations are very astute. There are major issues on which Trump and Sanders are allied on the same side, and Hillary is on the opposite. Not just that Hillary represents the establishment and the status quo and more of the same, but that Bernie and Trump are both opposed to the North American Free Trade Agreement, to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and to these endless wars in the Middle East. They're also allied in relation to the supporting the Second Amendment. I believe that if Hillary is nominated, that as many as two-thirds of Bernie Sanders supporters will gradually appreciate the overlap with Donald Trump and come to his support. That is my prediction. Hillary is in a most precarious position. She's trying to not offend Sanders supporters, but she did it just yesterday when she was denying that Donald Trump was qualified by asserting that she would be the Democratic nominee, that there was nothing that could be done to stop it. That was an insult to every supporter of Bernie Sanders, especially considering that when Hillary ran against Barack Obama, she's held on to the very last bitter end when it was already overwhelmingly obvious he would be the candidate, and did not withdraw to cast her support as she is requesting of Bernie Sanders. It's not going to happen for reasons such as those you articulate, Tony. And I think the Democrats are headed for a major divide.
And, of course, the saving grace would be that there's an honest law enforcement official somewhere in the United States to press charges to subject Hillary Clinton to the vast array of criminal, you know, implications of what she's been involved in. That would be, you know, too much to hope for. But this is the end of the show. Thank you, Gerard. Thank you so much for, there you are in Paris in front of the Arc de Triomphe, giving these fabulous perspectives from your European perch. Thank you, Professor Fetzer. Very incisive as usual. Thanks to Kevin Barrett, who's not here this week, and we'll tune in again. I hope hope you out there will give us a chance to bring analysis of the False Flag Weekly News next week. See you.
Less than 3% of you people read books. Because less than 15% of you read newspapers. Right now, there is a whole, an entire generation that never knew anything that didn't come out of this tube. This tube can make or break presidents, popes, prime ministers. Television is not the truth. Television is a circus, a carnival, a traveling troupe of acrobats, storytellers, dancers, singers, jugglers, sideshow freaks, lion tamers, and football players. We deal in illusions, man. None of it is true. But you people sit there day after day, night after night, all ages, colors, creeds.
Broadcasting live on network radio.
So turn off your television sets, turn them off now, turn them off and leave them off.
Now say, with moral certainty and considerable scientific authority, that the death of JFK was committed by a meticulously executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up. Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the silent historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
You're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
The Real Deal, where I'm very pleased to have as my special featured guest during this second hour, which will be hosted by Gary King, John Hankey, who has a variety of things to say. Gary, why don't you introduce our show for the new JFK program?
All right. Yeah, I would like to announce to everyone that this is the anniversary show, and we have a special guest. We have been at this for 2 years now. This is show number 104, and we're happy to have John Hankey, but we've got some really, really big news, and Larry's going to tell us about that. We have Jim Mars joining the OIC, coming on to over to our side. So, Larry, tell us all about that one.
Okay, hi, can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Good evening, everybody. Last week we had Jim Mars, you know, the author of Crossfire, the plot to kill John F. Kennedy, and which part of JFK, the movie by Oliver Stone, was based. Okay, and now that we mentioned JFK, the movie, I just wanted to add, you know, sort of to finish, you know, what we were talking about last week about Mark Lane, because we didn't have a chance. We sort of rushed into the end. But the movie Executive Action, before there was any JFK, there was executive action, and I believe in 1971 or 72, Jim, maybe you might want to correct me on that, but, you know, you had major stars like Burt Lancaster and Robert Ryan, and a cast of older type of actors, sort of like what happens in JFK, you know, where he's got Walter Matthau and Jack Lemmon, you know, participating in that movie, sort of like at the end of their careers, Jim. And maybe, you know, given that they were at the end of their careers, they were not as afraid to interpret a role of an actor, you know, who might have been involved in the JFK assassination. I find that very interesting.
Yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah, you need to unmute, Jim. Unmute.
Executive Action was a completely brilliant piece of work about the Dallas roots of the assassination. Oliver Stone focuses on New Orleans, Jim Garrison, Clay Shaw, Lee Oswald. But this was really about the Murchisons and the other powerful oil men in Dallas wanting to get rid of JFK, largely because he was threatening to cut the oil depletion allowance and because they wanted to get Lyndon, their boy, into office, preferring his policies to those of JFK. So the two films are highly complementary, Larry.
Yeah, since we were talking about Mark Lane, you know, I don't know, not very many people know that he was the major consultant to that movie. Okay, so when we see Executive Action, a lot of that storyline actually was brought out by Mark Lane.
I forgot about that. I forgot all about that. Mark Lane was involved with that.
And I just wanted to finish real quickly, you know. I love to watch that movie, you know, every now and then. And I noticed that he had motorcycle cops driving up the embankment on their motorcycles.
Brilliant. There you go.
So he might have had this, you know, much, you know, more better interpreted than what we might we've been led to.
Larry, when you went to see Executive Action, they gave you a little newspaper. It was the equivalent of about 8 pages. That had documentation and substantiation for every claim that was made in the film.
Yeah. Excellent movie, Jim. I have it. It's part of my DVD collection, you know, and it's, treasured. Trust me.
I tell you what, there's few people that have used Mark Lane's books as much as John Hankey. So, John, talk to us a little bit about Mark Lane and how he's influenced you. And I do want to make this point. In the world of JFK, no one has more video views than John Hankey's. We're talking in the millions. Webster Tarpley's got it on his website. So when it comes to the king of JFK videos, no one tops John Hankey. So welcome to the show, John Hankey.
Thank you so much, Gary.
Mm-hmm. So talk to us a little bit about Mark Lane.
Yeah, sure. I've spent years looking for the Bush, the Hoover memo, the memo that Hoover wrote 5 days after the assassination about the meeting that Hoover says took place the day after the assassination with Mr. George Bush of the Central Intelligence Agency. I'd heard a radio program where somebody mentioned it, and I spent years looking for it. The guy said it was on the Nation magazine, and I went to the library, and, you know, I'm looking through all these back issues, and I couldn't find it. And you'll find, in fact, that the libraries are wired to make it difficult for you to find stuff like that. Anyhow, it doesn't matter. The point is that the first place I got my hands on it was in Mark Lane's Rush to Judgment. Right. And, you know, it's a really, really a brilliant, well, from my point of view, particularly a brilliant book in terms of nailing E. Howard Hunt. And when you then look at Hunt's connections to George H.W. Bush, you drag Bush in 4 or 5 different ways in addition to the Hoover memo. You have 4 or 5 other connections of Bush to the assassination. So Mark Lane provided all of that. Mark Lane's the guy who released the Zapruder film, and for all of its weaknesses, right, for the manipulations of the serious and important manipulations of the Zapruder film, nevertheless, I was this idiot, doty, doty, do, walking down the street. You know, I was a very good student, quote unquote, right? I mean, I was good at following orders, and I was, you know, I had my head so far up my behind, I didn't know whether it was night or noon, and I saw the Zapruder film, and you could hear the pop. It was audible as my head popped out from my backside, and I realized, at least I realized how ignorant I was, right? If the Zapruder film was not reliable in terms of showing the limousine stuff, if it wasn't reliable in showing the very, 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 very deep involvement and central involvement of the Secret Service in the assassination, it did help you get your head out of your backside in terms of understanding that everything you had been told was a lie, and you needed to re-educate yourself, and not just on the Kennedy assassination, but on every single historical event that is of any significance. The chances are better than good that you don't know anything.
And of course, you're primarily alluding to the fact that you see JFK had moved violently back and to the left, which is obviously indicative of a shot from the front, or from the right front, which is inconsistent with all the shots having been fired from behind, which you'd been told by the Warren Commission.
And accepted, right? I mean, my family were devotees of John Kennedy. We had all these Life magazines. I had an LP of Kennedy's speeches before he was assassinated, right? My father came home when Kennedy was running for election with all these pins, and his kids were running around with big JFK pins. And I accepted everything that the Warren Commission had to say until I saw the Zapruder film, and now I was on my way. And we owe it to Mark Lane that we got our hands on the Zapruder film, right? He's the guy who took it from Garrison and duplicated it and spread it around and told the people that he gave it to make as many copies as they could. And I bumped into one of those in Los Angeles.
Yeah, It's hard to measure Mark Lane's achievements. Just like before, I'd forgotten all about the movie that Larry is talking about. It's just amazing. So, all right, now, Mr. Hanke, we want you to talk a little bit about the recent thing going on at the Enquirer. We're talking about Ted Cruz being in New Orleans.
No, and, his father, Raphael.
The father, I'm sorry about that. And also, at Sitka, they completely reject any of this whatsoever, that Raphael Cruz had anything to do, and this is as much hogwash as could possibly be.
So, Jeff, let's look at the first slide. John, were you aware that Sitka rejects the idea that Raphael Cruz was in New Orleans? I mean, this is stunning.
I don't pay any attention to Sitka, and it's my suggestion. I discussed with Gary that I wanted to do the Gary King stuff, and then as quickly as we possibly can, and then come back. I think that this question of Raphael Cruz is really, really important. And is everybody agreeable to that?
Well, no, it's already up in terms of the slide set, John. Let's start here with this. Yeah.
Well, except I want to go into some detail and depth on this particular topic.
And that's just fine. Fine.
Okay, good. I think that one of the points I want to make is the importance of collegiality, and that it's so desperately a college is where you get together with other serious researchers and students. The professors are supposed to be students, and you argue with each other. You put your ideas up in the audience that your colleagues are supposed to argue with you. They're supposed to help you find the flaws in your argument and the flaws in your evidence. And in doing that, they help you hone your argument and hone your evidence, and very, very likely will help you draw conclusions that you hadn't seen on your own. For example, Judith Baker raises the issue that Lee Harvey Oswald wasn't a bad guy, right? Lee Harvey Oswald was a hero. And if Lee Harvey Oswald was leafleting and Ted Cruz's father was helping him, that doesn't indicate that Ted Cruz's father was involved in the assassination. It indicates that he was involved with Oswald, but I think there's some very, very, really important distinctions to be made. And I hadn't thought about any of those subtleties until Judith raised that issue. And then I started thinking about it. And feel free to interrupt me at any point, but it's my observation that there were CIA anti-Castro thugs on the street where Oswald was leafleting.
Sure. Shall we look at the next slide?
If you like. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I think that Michael Payne was one of those operatives there.
Yeah, on the far left. And Charles just got out here on the right, of course.
My understanding is that the one person in that slide who is not identified is the guy who looks like Raphael Cruz.
Right.
The rest of them have been identified as CIA asset anti-Castro Cubans. Am I mistaken about that?
Basically correct. And, of course, Oswald was being sheep-dipped and given such
right.
a persona himself in order to be nailed as the patsy in Dallas.
Well, we have Chauncey Holt there, Jim, that we
sure.
have
of course.
Well, who? But Chauncey Holt was involved in the assassination.
Of course. He's identified everyone here as having been a part of Operation Mongoose.
There
right?
you go. He has
Let's not forget that Jim Garrison said, and it's one of the biggest impressions he ever made on me, that every single person that he investigated that had anything to do with Lee Oswald was involved with the Central Intelligence Agency. Every single one. So almost by default, right there, we already know it's nothing but CIA surrounding him now.
And but that's just an amazing coincidence, Gary.
Yeah. Who's the guy in the middle? Oh, we couldn't figure that one out.
Okay.
If he cracks like a duck, huh?
If he cracks like a duck, we might have a duck.
But
go, John.
Thank you. Judith draws the distinction that Oswald was CIA connected and Oswald was not involved in the assassination. Right? Not everybody who's involved in the CIA is dirty. But I think it's fairly safe to say that everybody who was involved in Operation Mongoose was dirty. And most of them, if not all of them, were in Dallas, right? I mean, Chauncey Holt is far from the from Operation Mongoose were in Dallas that day and, in fact, in Dealey Plaza, right? But Oswald was not involved in the assassination. Oswald was one of the good guys, CIA connected, but one of the good guys. Go ahead.
Well, a lot of us, Garrett, Larry, go ahead.
No, if I may, I just wanted to mention that, if anything, Judith is very clear in establishing that Lee was part of an abort team.
That's right.
Okay, so go ahead. You can continue.
Well, so, right, but he was, right, you have CIA people who are part of an abort team who are genuinely part of an abort team.
Right.
You have CIA people, I think, who are nominally part of an abort team, but in fact are involved in the assassination. But they are identified as being part of an abort team in case they get their picture taken standing in front of the school book depository and somebody says, what the hell are you doing standing in front of the school book depository? They can say, I'm part of an abort team. If they get photographed anywhere, they can say, oh, I was part of an abort team. And I think that Oswald was, well, Judith knows what she knows, and I don't think that she knows particularly what Oswald's involvement was, but so in any case, but it was her comments that made me take a step back. And the step, I took a big step back and I said, well, wait a minute. Oswald's mama said she thought he was FBI. His best friend at the, I think it's the Riley Coffee Company, but it could be a different employer, said that he thought he was FBI. If I'm not mistaken, the guy who ran the garage at the Riley Coffee Company, it was the guy who ran the garage, but I'm not sure of which employer it was, said that Oswald, he saw Oswald meeting with guys who were driving a car. He thought the guys were FBI. When he checked their paperwork, it said that they were Secret Service. Well, I think that they were deep FBI who were using the cover that they were Secret Service, because the Secret Service, Oswald, if Oswald was meeting with Secret Service guys, that doesn't make him look innocent. That makes him look guilty. I think he was meeting with FBI guys and that the cover was so deep that the garage attendant looked at the guys and said FBI, but he looked at the paperwork and it said Secret Service. Well, never mind. So the step that I want people to take is, if Oswald was, and Wagoner Carr, right? The
Attorney General
of the state of Texas calls up the Warren Commission the first day that they're meeting and says, Oswald is an FBI agent, employee number S179. He's getting paid $200 a month. I think it took me 30 years to look at that information for the 7,000th time and say he had his paycheck and stub in the guy in his hand.
Which is why we can't get the W-2 forms for the alleged assassin of the 35th president.
Right.
Because all the government couldn't put its hands on them.
53 years later, how many years later are we?
How absurd can you get?
Well, we can get as absurd as you want. Anyway, the point is, I think I am willing to say with confidence that Oswald was working for the FBI. He wasn't working for the FBI passing out those leaflets so that, right, in his ears, in his mind, he's not passing out leaflets so that he can be set up as the assassin of JFK. What is the story that he thinks that he's doing? And so you take another big step back. What was the FBI doing? What was the most important thing that the FBI was doing? And I'll run you through my answer. It'll take me a minute and a half, and then you can argue with me if you care to. The Cuban Missile Crisis, I think people would probably agree, was the biggest red shooting star on John Kennedy's agenda. It's the biggest mistake he ever made in his life, letting that come to pass. And when it was over, he and Khrushchev said, well, what the hell happened? How did we get to this point? Because neither one of them wanted to be, you know, with their fingers on the trigger and the world in the balance. You know, how did that happen? And Khrushchev said, well, you guys were carrying out terrorist raids against Cuba and you were preparing to invade. And Kennedy said, What? What do you mean we were preparing to invade? And that's a little difficult to swallow, but I'm telling you, there's a U.S. government document called Operation Zapata. Prouty, Fletcher Prouty goes on and on about this particular document. It's difficult to get your hands on. I apologize for not having posted it myself. But in that document, it says that the CIA proposed the invasion of Cuba at the Bay of Pigs, and Kennedy said no D-Day style invasion. All right, it's about five lines, his response to that proposal, and then they launched a D-Day style invasion. So my point is that the CIA paid absolutely no attention to what Kennedy had to say about Cuba. They launched the D-Day style invasion, and they continued to carry out these raids against his orders, and they continued to run these training camps preparing for an invasion of Cuba right up to the day that Kennedy was assassinated. And in solving and resolving the missile crisis, Kennedy promised Khrushchev that he would stop the terrorist raids, and he promised that he would stop the training for an invasion, and it didn't happen. And Castro called up Khrushchev screaming at Khrushchev saying, hey, they're still doing it. And Khrushchev called up Kennedy screaming, hey, they're still doing it. And Kennedy called in Hoover and said, get them.
Yeah, he's talking about the Lake Pontchartrain camps, the training camps for Lake
Pontchartrain. Correct. And so how did Hoover find out about the Lake Pontchartrain camps? I think it's more than obvious. There's pictures of Sturgis and Oswald at the Pontchartrain camps. How much more evidence do you need to come to the conclusion that Hoover sent Oswald to locate the Pontchartrain camps? Oswald located them, and they got shut down as a result of Oswald's work on behalf of the FBI. The question is, how did Oswald locate them? And this is surmise on my part, but I think you'll find it appealing. In any case, you'll find that it completely accords with the evidence, right? It perfectly meshes with the evidence. I think that Hoover called up his old friend Guy Bannister, who used to be the head of the FBI office in Chicago, and said, I'm sheep dipping this guy. We're trying to infiltrate the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. Give him a hand. And Bannister says, yeah, all right. And they send Oswald down there. Bannister sets him up. There's no argument about that. Bannister set him up, gave him an office in the same building, gave him all the secretarial privileges that he needed, anything Oswald needed. Bannister's secretary was at his disposal to write, print the stuff up, make the copies, hand it to him, and provide any other assistance and help that he needed. In this process of doing that, Oswald rekindled his old relationship with David Ferry, who was a senior staffer at the Pontchartrain camp. He wheedled his way into Pontchartrain. He had to go to gay orgies with David Ferry at Clay Shaw's house to do it. But in the process, he wheedled his way in. He got his butt to Lake Pontchartrain. He got himself photographed, I don't think on purpose. And the FBI swooped in and shut them down. Now, well, I should say, go ahead, argue with that anybody who wants to, but I think
you're being overly bifurcating. I mean, Oswald was recruited as a Marine Corps in the Marine Corps by the Office of Naval Intelligence. He was stationed at Tsugi. He was on a mission for the CIA with his pseudo defection to the Soviet Union. When he returned,
he was
still working with, you know, on multiple tracks. It's absolutely correct that he was an informant for the FBI. But here in New Orleans, I mean, look, you're surrounded by CIA operatives here, and Lee was one of them. And when you say he wasn't involved in the assassination, I think that's a very curious way to put it, John, because clearly he was on the fringe. He was intended to figure out what was going on and do what he could to thwart it. That would be my most charitable interpretation of Lee's role here. And, of course, he wound up being hung out to dry.
My interpretation is this one, and hats off to Webster Tarpley. And, you know, like I'm saying, I really believe in the importance of having colleagues and carrying on discussions with people who are fierce researchers and who are fierce defenders of their position. Webster Tarpley says that Mohammed Atta was involved in Able Danger, and everybody saw that, right? Mohammed Atta, for the people in the audience who don't know, is supposedly the lead of the 9/11 attacks, and obviously that's anybody who knows anything about the 9/11 attacks can see that that's patently false. But so what was he doing? Well, he was involved in Able Danger, and the Republicans in the Congress were saying, look, we have all of this evidence that Mohammed Atta was involved in this U.S. government program, Able Danger. What the hell was going on? dead silence. And, you know, it went on silent, the response from the administration, until people stopped asking the question and they swept it under the carpet the best they could. And Tarpley says that Abel Danger was the B team. Is in intelligence parlance, it's the B team. In football parlance, it's the red shirts. And in, let's talk football. In red shirts, you have these guys who you call in and they put on red shirts and then they study and run the offense of the team you're going to be playing against next week. Yep. So that you can practice against it.
John, look, the JFK is complicated enough, much less compounding it with 9/11. Let's return to the scenario.
Absolutely, absolutely.
If I read you right, your nuanced approach is to imply that Rafael Cruz, although captured in this photograph, was not necessarily a bad guy. That seems to me what you're seeking to establish here.
Well, I'm more interested at the moment in talking about Oswald and Oswald's role. I think that when the CIA discovered that it was Oswald who had done what Kennedy and the FBI had failed to do for 3 years, which is locate Pontchartrain and shut it down, when they figured out it was him, they sent, who was Oswald's supervisor in the CIA? David Attlee Phillips. David Attlee Phillips went to Oswald and said, look, we want you to run B-team operations. You're going to run them in Dallas. You're going to meet with Jack Ruby, right? There's all this evidence that Oswald was meeting. And there's at least two very, very, very solid pieces of evidence that Oswald was working, cooperating with Ruby in the weeks before, the couple of weeks before the assassination. I think they told him, you're going to plot as loudly and publicly as you can to assassinate the president. We'll see if the Secret Service can pick it up. We'll see if the FBI can pick it up. Mm-hmm. And then, see, and this is, it does in so neatly. You see, I've never thought that the Miami operation to assassinate Kennedy, it was paper thin. It never seemed to me that it was authentic. Same thing in Chicago. It never seemed to me that it was authentic. And what I think they did, because look, here's the huge problem that this explains, which is how do you explain that Hoover wrote a memo saying there's going to be an attempt on the president's life in Dallas on November 22nd. And Kennedy went to Dallas on November 22nd. And I think the Secret Service went to Kennedy and said, look, we busted the guys in Chicago. We busted the guys in Miami. The guys in Dallas are our guys. Don't worry about it. We got a handle on this. Hoover is reporting to you what he's heard, but the people the noise from are our people. You don't need to worry. Go on down to Dallas. I think that that's how they got Kennedy to ignore Hoover's warning.
Sorting out where I agree and disagree with what you've been describing here would be a rather undertaking. Let me just say,
sure.
Are you implying that the Inquirer had the article wrong, that Donald Trump was mistaken in saying they should be following it up? Have you seen any of our programs on this before? Because we've done quite a bit on this very topic right here on this show.
Yes, I have. But so what you're saying, what I hear you saying is let's get back to Rafael Cruz.
Yeah,
let's do that. Sure. Let's get back to Rafael Cruz. And what I have to say about Rafael Cruz, given what I believe that Oswald was a member of a B team. I think that Ruby was a member of a B team. Maybe we can set that aside and focus on Rafael Cruz. And my insight on Rafael Cruz is Sylvia Odio. And let me take a step back again and say, look, the Sylvia Odio's father was anti-Castro, but he was not pro-mafia. He was anti-Castro, but he was fiercely anti-Batista. And in being fiercely anti-Batista, and he was also very pro-land reform, and he was pro-democracy. And in being all of those, he was at fierce odds with the fascists in the CIA. He was not a friend of the fascists in the CIA. He was a good friend of Kennedy. And the Kennedys were trying to promote Odio. And I think that that's why the fascists in the CIA took Lee Harvey Oswald to Sylvia Odio's door in order to link her to Oswald, who was then linked to the assassination in an attempt to link Odio to Oswald's assassination. You will recall, of course, that there was a plan and we're sort of, I think all of us, cloudy on how this fits into the big picture, but somebody high ranking in the CIA forged audio tapes of somebody who was not Oswald supposedly being in Mexico City and talking to a high-ranking assassination supervisor at the Russian embassy. And the morning after the assassination, the head of McComb calls up Johnson and says, the Russians planned this stuff. And
John, we even have photographed, you know, of Rafael Cruz on Main Street in Dallas standing beside Antonio Vecchiano.
Set that aside.
Wait a minute. We got this guy on one hand down in New Orleans handing out leaflets with Lee Oswald. Then he's on Houston on the day JFK is being whacked with Antonio Vecchiano, who was the founder of Alpha 66. And you're telling me, is this your position, that he had nothing to do with the assassination?
On Main Street.
Nothing to do with the assassination. He's saying that it was Cruz there.
No, I'm not saying that it was Cruz in Dallas.
No, in New Orleans.
In New Orleans, that photo looks like Cruz.
Right. That but photo, you were saying that even without the photo, there was plenty of reason for him to be there.
Thank you so much, Gary. Thank you, Gary. Very, very much. What I'm saying is that Rafael Cruz, like Sylvia Odio's father, was against Batista. Rafael Cruz left Cuba when Batista was in power. He was not an he was subject to being accused of being pro-Castro. Because he left Cuba before Castro came to power, he was clearly anti-Batista, and he was subject to a threat from the CIA. You're pro-Castro, and not only, if you're lucky, we're going to deport you, because otherwise we're throwing your butt in jail.
John, we know that Rafael Cruz was in New Orleans in 1963.
Yes,
we know
that's
he
right.
was an anti-Castro Cuban. He appears to have been there. We have multiple photo confirmations. Judith Baker met him when she was collaborating with Lee in the development of the rapid-acting polio vaccine. So she's confirmed his presence too.
Oh.
And then we have what I regard as, you know, a clear photograph. It's such a famous photograph. I actually put it on the cover of Assassination Science when I published my first collection of expert studies in 1998, with no idea that it happened to include a photograph of Rafael Cruz standing beside Antonio Vecchiano. So, I mean, I'm just very puzzled in a predicament about what you are attempting to tell us about Rafael.
Let me say this. I don't know, okay? I'm merely making the observation. I'm merely trying to invoke the subtlety that I was, the path that I was set on by Judith Baker, that we should appreciate the fact that the being connected to these guys, as Oswald was, doesn't mean that you were on their side. Now, hang on, let me say this because I think it's interesting. This is, at the time that Oswald is leafleting, I believe, certainly very, very near that time, Lansdale is writing Operation Northwoods. Lansdale is the CIA case officer for Cuba, and he's writing Operation Northwoods saying we should be setting off bombs and then blaming it on Cuban nationals in the country.
Yeah, shooting down airliners in Cuba.
Yes, that's right. But let's get back to Rafael Cruz. If we set off bombs in the United States and blame it on Cuban nationals, I can name one, Rafael Cruz. We'll sweep his ass up and we'll say he did it. And look, he's clearly pro-Castro because he left before Castro came to power. He's a Castro operative in the country. And look, he's connected to Lee Harvey Oswald. They've set him up. Look, we have pictures of him passing out Fair Play for Cuba photographs. I don't know, but it strikes me that there's that possibility. And look, when the CIA has cards in their hand, you don't know how they're going to play them, and they don't know how they're going to play them. We have all of these operatives, and, okay, we're going to play this guy in this situation, and we're going to play that guy, and we're going to set up this patsy here, and we're going to set up that patsy there. And Rafael Cruz was a sitting duck to be set up for, to be blamed for a bombing that had been carried out by the CIA with the
was he blamed for a bombing that was set off by the CIA, John?
Was he? There were no bombings that I'm aware of.
So you're talking about a hypothetical. There are dozens of different imaginary stories we could weave, like the one you're weaving here.
Okay.
It does not seem to me to advance our understanding of Rafael Cruz or what he was doing in New Orleans with Lee Oswald and what he was doing in Dallas with Antonio Venciana.
Well,
I just wanted to mention a couple of things about Rafael Cruz that we have discussed here for a while here. And first of all, his exit out of Cuba and where he ended up at the University of Texas, obtaining very prestigious degrees, you know, in mathematics and computer science, which at the time were very high echelon curriculums, Jim. You know, and then you know him disappearing all of a sudden after the assassination to Calgary. You know, and, you know, all of this adds up to something that just doesn't smell
and
right.
And going to work for Zapata.
Yeah, no, and for what's the name of the outfit in Texas, the big oil company?
Halliburton?
Yeah, Halliburton, yeah, exactly.
He worked for Halliburton.
Yes.
But after the assassination, he hightailed it out to Canada and became a Canadian citizen.
Right, and the reason is because he had already registered for the Selective Service, and then he said, you know, I'm out of here, you know, because he didn't want to go to Vietnam.
Well, that's an excuse. That makes sense. Well, except that.
Jim Garrison hot on his tail.
But he had the CIA to defend him.
Yeah. John, alas, we've consumed more than half of the time featuring you here, and we want to hear your views about Gary Webb. And,
sure, let's do that.
Let's go to slide number 4, please, Chance.
Okay, very good. And as anybody who's listening will have noted, Jim and I butt heads all the time, and we don't agree about LBJ's involvement in the assassination, and we don't agree about Kennedy's womanizing. And Jim,
I don't know. Do we have any different? Jack did a lot of womanizing, John. I'm not sure we're in opposite ends on that.
We are. I don't believe that he did. But hang on. And D'Eugenio and I agree that LBJ wasn't involved. And D'Eugenio and I agree that that JFK didn't do a bunch of womanizing. But my point is that being a colleague doesn't mean that you agree with people. That's not what being a colleague means. So. Being a colleague means you respect each other, you listen to each other. It means that you shut up and listen while the other guy is criticizing you. You give the other guy time and space to criticize, and all of this is based on your mutual effort, your mutual desire to find the truth. You're not defending your position because it's your position. You are involved in this really, really, really difficult struggle to find the truth, and you have the deepest respect for people who are involved in that similar struggle, whether or not they agree with you. And
well, John, I'm sorry to say I'm convinced that 90% of the JFK research community is working the other side of the street.
Well, it doesn't matter.
And I'm not at all sympathetic to those I have identified as working to promote disinformation.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Go ahead.
Now, and Jim D'Eugenio is prime among them, in case you have any doubts about it.
He's not a colleague, and that's what my presentation tonight is. The point of my presentation tonight is that D'Eugenio is not a colleague. He's a scumbag.
Very good.
I had some very choice words for him that I don't think they wouldn't be professional, but I think we're ready to go to the next slide. I'm ready to go to the next slide. I'm not particular. I don't want to spend more time than necessary talking about D'Eugenio.
Keep going.
Okay, good. Well, the next slide is dangerous words. This is David Denby. He's the premier movie reviewer at the New Yorker magazine, which is, they would appreciate me saying, the premier literary magazine in the United States, and has been for 50 years at least, and maybe 80 years, the premier. And so they think a lot of themselves, and they think a lot of their movie reviews, and they think a lot of their movie reviewers. And the Kill the Messenger movie about Gary Webb, if Denby reviewed it, that shows that they had a lot of respect for this movie. It shows, you know, particular involvement. And next slide, please. You see down at the bottom, it says, even his skeptics would have to admit that he must have been a very strong-willed man to shoot himself in the head twice.
It is a remarkable feat. I'm reminded of Henry Marshall, who shot himself 5 times with a single-shot bolt-action rifle hit himself on the head to render himself unconscious and had lungs filled with carbon monoxide, but was pronounced to be a suicide.
Mac Wallace.
Yeah, Mac Wallace.
But I want you to notice a couple of things. The New Yorker's literary. So this is ironic. This statement, the New Yorker is not going to say what we will see a reviewer in a minute say, which is what the hell you mean he shot himself in the head twice? How did he get off that second shot? I'd like to know that. And, you know, Gary Webb was using a police special, and I had an expert in firearms tell me that if you stick a police special to your head and pull the trigger, the explosion is going to kill you before the bullet does. A police special is made to be such a powerful weapon that if you wound a suspect, it will knock them to the ground. Because suspects were killing, they would be mortally wounded by the police, but before they died, they'd get off a fatal shot at the pursuing officers, and they wanted something so that when the officer shot this guy, he went down, whether he was wounded or not, but particularly if he was mortally wounded, put him down so he stopped shooting at us. And so, right, this is a very, very powerful weapon, and you can't shoot yourself in the head twice. But so two things I want to notice, and let's move on because we've got some stuff to cover. Dangerous words. Dangerous? Where's the danger? Is Denby trying to say that if a reporter writes the things about the CIA, that's dangerous because they might commit suicide? That doesn't make any sense. He's not saying it's dangerous because you might commit suicide. He's saying it's dangerous because you might find yourself being so strong-willed that you can't face the world. You can't face life anymore, but you can't shoot yourself in the head twice. If you're strong-willed, you're not going to commit suicide because you're strong-willed, right? But so my point is that I think that the New Yorker reviewer is being ironic and is saying, look, Gary Webb lived a dangerous life, and it was dangerous because the CIA wanted him dead and they killed him. That's what was dangerous about it. If that isn't what he's saying, then what was he saying was dangerous? But let's go on to the next slide if nobody has any objections. So this is the Los Angeles Times. And again, next slide. This is Kenneth Turan, who is the premier. He's the senior reviewer at the Los Angeles Times. He reviews the movies that he wants to review.
No,
and he doesn't.
No chance. Go back one.
No, that's it. Oh, no, you're right. It doesn't matter.
Go back, chance number eight.
Okay, fine. That's fine. But it's really interesting. I think it just tickles me that this guy is writing for the Los Angeles Times. And if you look at the highlight, it says that the Los Angeles Times attempted to discredit Webb's reporting. And then it quotes the movie saying you get the most flack when you're right about the target. So what is this reviewer saying? He's saying the LA Times tried to discredit Webb, and it's saying that Webb was right. This guy is sticking a knife in the editors at the LA Times saying you guys attacked Webb and he was right. And then next slide, he also says, kill the messenger is a cautionary tale. It's like the words dangerous words. It's a cautionary tale, but for crusading journalists, keeping themselves safe from Gary Webb's fate may be easier said than done. Keeping yourself from shooting yourself in the head twice, you would think it wouldn't be too hard to keep yourself from shooting yourself in the head two times. But so obviously, again, this is ironic, right? To say that this is dangerous, to say that it's a cautionary tale, it's a warning to journalists, be careful you don't tell the truth about the CIA, right? He just said Webb told the truth, but be careful, that should be a cautionary tale, because if you tell the truth about the CIA, you might end up committing suicide by shooting yourself in the head twice. And my point is that the New Yorker and the LA Times both had these powerful, I think, reviews that were so the opposite of what either of those magazines ever does in terms of coming within 100 miles of the truth about a conspiracy. Here, they're both running right up and at least stomping on it with their ironic feet, saying, Gary Webb got killed by the CIA. Next slide, please.
Yeah, John, you were saying that the explosion of the gun would kill you before the bullet does?
That's what an expert in firearms told me. She was a lawyer.
I think that's going to become really important later on in the presentation, so I'm just not going to blow it.
Okay. All right. Movie review. Kill the Messenger.
Sorry, John. I just wanted to make a small correction.
Sure.
Real quick. It was Schlumberger where Rafael Cruz had worked. Okay, it wasn't Halliburton. Okay, I just
okay.
wanted.
Okay. All right. But so here's the Huffington Post, and I don't know if anybody here reads the Huffington Post. I hate the Huffington Post. They make me nauseous typically when I find something from them. They're disgustingly, I think, sellouts on almost every score. Next slide. He ended up committing suicide with two shots to his brain. Suicide? How could he pull the trigger twice after he had shot himself once in the brain? Now, so here you have three reviews where the reporters, I mean, the LA Times never did anything but attack the hell out of Gary Webb. And I think that we can, I think, according to the guy who wrote the LA Times review, the reason they attacked Webb is because they were being cautious and they didn't want to shoot themselves. And so
well,
they
John, bear in mind, the CIA has infiltrated every newsroom and every
oh yeah,
every network in the country.
What do you mean? Network. What do you mean? Infiltrate?
William Bowlby told us that the agency owns everyone of significance in the mass media.
Yes, I don't think the word is infiltrated. They run them.
They own it.
Yes, right. It's from the top down. If anybody who gets anywhere, anybody who doesn't lie their asses off 7 days a week or tell the truth and end up shooting themselves in the head. Is a CIA operative. But my point is that you have these three sources that never tell the truth, that never come within 100 miles of telling the truth. The guy at the LA Times sticks a knife in the throat of not to the throat, but in the throat of the editors at the LA Times. And how do you account for this? And I was thinking, well, you know, maybe because these guys are movie reviewers, they're not as attuned to the threats that are posed by news reporters if they tell the truth. And there may be an element of that, but I, you know, on the other hand, they're writing reviews in which they're talking about this reporter who got killed with two shots to the head. So they, how could they have missed the inherent threat in saying anything positive about Gary Webb? It seems to me that they had to have been aware of the danger of saying what they said, and they said it anyway. And how could they have done that? And my answer to that is they were inspired by the movie. They were inspired by the just amazing courage and brilliance of Gary Webb. And they said, geez, you know, we have to be people. We have to be human beings. We have to stand up a little bit for truth and justice. That they were moved from the grave. They were moved by Gary Webb to do the right thing. And I think that that's so brilliant and so wonderful. And piss on Jim DiEugenio. Next slide. Because that ain't him, right? You go, yeah, that's just more from the Huffington Post. Did he expose two powerful forces to go on living, right? You can see the irony in that. That doesn't compute, except ironically, that exposing forces would make you want to stop living. No, but it would move those powerful forces. They murder you.
Make you stop living.
Next slide, please. Consortium News, Jim DiEugenio. So, you know, all right, that's just to show you he...
John, what's he doing writing for Consortium News?
No stuff. It is such a dark spot. It's such a blemish on Robert Perry that he would be promoting Jim DiEugenio, and I can't answer that question other than to say apparently Perry's not... Certainly Perry is infiltrated. That's what I think, is that, you know, Perry's not a young guy, and you know, look, you know, you have taken on Gary King to assist you in doing your stuff. Well, Robert Perry has taken on Lisa Pease and Jim DiEugenio to assist him in doing his stuff. And Jim DiEugenio and Lisa Pease have such good credentials. They were so important to the writing of JFK and the Unspeakable that they must be trustworthy, mustn't they? No, these guys are deep operatives. Next slide, please. Next slide. In this quote, DiEugenio says, he's talking about Freeway Ricky Ross, who was the largest drug dealer in L.A. by many, many times, and whose trial came to Gary Webb's attention. And in the process of paying attention to that, it became very, very clear that Webb was getting, I'm sorry, that Ricky Ross was getting all of his cocaine from CIA operatives. And Eugenio throws this in. He was nicknamed Freeway Rick because he made so much money selling drugs that he purchased properties along the Harbor Freeway, including motels and theaters. Ricky Ross has spoken to my students at Manual Arts High School four times. He's spoken to many hundreds of students. It hasn't gotten me in good. It didn't get me in good with the administrators there, and I ended up retiring because I wanted to do this kind of research full time rather than fight those guys.
Because you didn't want to shoot yourself twice in the head?
I'm still working on that one. Anyway, but my point is, where did Eugenio come up with this crap? He just made it up. He just didn't. Ricky Ross is very well known to me, right? And he and I have spoken for hundreds of hours, probably. And I know friends of his and so on. Anyway, the point is, Ricky Ross told me that they called him Freeway Rick when he was a little kid because his house was right next to the freeway. They widened the freeway, knocked down the house. And this is 10 years later, he becomes a drug dealer, but in the neighborhood, he was still Freeway Rick because that's what his name was, right? If your name is Lil Hanky Loke, because when Big Hanky Loke is Big Hanky Loke, and so you're Lil, when you're 30, you're still Lil Hanky Loke because that was your name, right? It's your moniker and you carry it with you. You're Placa in Spanish, they would say it, right? Anyway, the point that I want to make as quickly as possible is that here we're confronted with Eugenio just making stuff up. Why would he bother to make it up? And I guess the answer, it's not a bad question, but one, you have to be confronted by the fact that he makes stuff up apparently. And secondly, he's making it up in order to sound credible, like he knows the subject that he's talking about. Anyway, next slide. And I'm going to go through this quickly because it makes me sick in my stomach to talk about it.
Yeah, but we have the time.
I know, but we can talk about something else when we're done.
Eugenio
in the same review, and I just wrote it up on a slide because it was easy to see, said that in describing Gary Webb's death, the first shot only wounded him, so he fired again.
And
this is in the Consortium News. There was no investigation, zero. They didn't bother to look around the room to see where the bullets entered and exited. Where did they go? We don't know because there was zero investigation. There was no autopsy. Where does he come up with this crap?
Lisa Keys knew, though.
But next slide, please. On the consortium, they've taken this down. On the this response, on the consortium website, there was a post from a guy who called himself Working Hard, and he said, he asked Eugenio, he said, man, Jim, I have so much respect for you. Why are you pandering to the suicide conclusion? And I can tell you that, you know, I went to the theater and watched it. I watched Kill the Messenger. Everybody in that theater was, you know, angry and moved that, you know, you weren't going to find anybody who didn't think that Gary Webb was murdered. They set it up. They wanted you to think that. They show all of these threats. He's getting threatened. He's getting threatened. He's getting threatened. You see a guy show up in his room at night and you think, all right, here they are. They're going to shoot him in the head twice. And they don't. It's a CIA guy who came to confess and he didn't know who else to tell. So he woke Gary Webb up in the middle of the night to tell him anyway. So that when then the last thing that you see on the screen is this black screen with these white letters saying that Gary Webb shot him, was found with two bullets in the head and it was ruled a suicide. And everybody, you can hear the gasp in the crowd. A suicide? What the hell are you talking about? But I'll throw in quickly that when this happened, I'm going to make it a long story short. I contacted everybody I could find to say, look, we got to do something about this. And nobody was doing anything. And somebody I talked to was able to give me the phone number of Cyril Weck. And I called Cyril Weck and he agreed to do the autopsy for half his usual fee. And he told me that of 35,000 autopsies he had done, he had never seen a two headshot suicide. He was very interested. And he also explained to me that you could very easily in an autopsy determine whether somebody was dead when they're shot by a bullet, because when you're alive, your veins are very inflated. It's like telling the difference between a balloon that was shot with a bullet when it was inflated and a balloon that was shot with a bullet when it was deflated. He said, it's very easy. Anyway, so Eugenio gets confronted by one of his fans who says that he's pandering, and he doesn't respond. Lisa Pease responds, which is rather weird, don't you think? And it makes me think that perhaps Pease wrote the thing in the first place and just put Eugenio's name on it. Anyway, Pease responds, the first shot through his mouth, exited his cheek, no serious damage done. The second shot was at a higher angle and entered his brain, killing him instantly.
Wait, hold on there, John. Didn't you tell me that you die from just the explosion alone?
Yes, you would die from the explosion alone. If you put the gun in your mouth, there's no freaking way that you would not get. I mean, if you stick the gun in your mouth, it's aimed at your medulla oblongata, your brain stem, which controls your breathing and heartbeat. There's, right? It's very effective. But you could do it with a blank.
Lisa P. said it went through his cheek, huh?
Which is very, 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 very interesting. You'll see that in a second. Next slide, please. And working hard responds, your account of the trajectory of the first bullet conflicts with all other reports of his death I have seen. Please provide some references. And Lisa P's response, next slide, should have been the killers told me. She doesn't respond. That was it. They shut it down and then they erased working hard and I don't know who else's. But I just Googled, right, the words that I had copied down off the screen. I Googled them and they don't show up anywhere anymore. But they used to take you to the Consortium News website. Anyway, if Lisa Pease didn't get it from the killers, she just made it up. But either answer, if you say, oh, she just made it up, well, why the hell would she make up a story to say that Gary Webb didn't commit suicide when he's so clearly obvious, I'm sorry, to say that Gary Webb did commit suicide. Why would you bother to make up a story like that? And I think, next slide, please. The answer is that she got it from the killers. Now, I hired an investigator and, you know, I have real qualms about putting this slide up because Gary Webb deserves some privacy, doesn't he? And as Cyril Wecht explained to me, no, he doesn't. That when somebody is murdered, the coroner doesn't give a crap if the family wants the body cremated. If a guy has killed himself with two shots to the head, the coroner doesn't give a damn. They want to do an autopsy and they also want to see who's the beneficiary on his insurance. And if the family wants to insist that the body should be cremated, that's only going to arouse suspicion that the family was involved in what was obviously a murder. How about you see there that the bullet exited Gary's cheek? How the hell did Lisa Pease know that the bullet exited Gary's cheek? Now, I hired an investigator who went to the morgue and ran into the family and told the family, his ex-wife and his sons, what he was up to. And the wife signed a thing giving us permission to do the autopsy and then walked him in and allowed him to examine the body. And he took this photograph. Lisa Pease didn't do that. Where did she come up with this other than that the killers told her that, well, you know, I'd invite Lisa Pease to answer that freaking question. I say that she got it from the killers, that she's involved with the killers. I don't think that this necessarily indicts Jim DiEugenio for being anything but a stupid idiot that he would listen to Lisa Pease and a non-professional investigator that he won't engage in debate with people because they disagree with him. You know, shove it, Jim.
Looking at these wounds, John, neither of them looks to me like an exit wound. They both look to me like they could be entrance wounds. What do you think? Larry?
Yeah, that's exactly what JFK's front throat wound looked like.
I hear you both. My investigator said he couldn't find, those were the only two wounds he could find. He examined his body carefully and he thought that the bullets must have been fired into his ear, into his ear on the opposite side of his head.
You know, so the below the cross, the lower thing, there are a whole lot of little marks there on the face that would be from the residue from the gunpowder hitting the face. In other words, that was virtually right. The gun was put up right next to his face.
Depending on the distance.
Yeah, it's got to be calculated, right?
Well, okay, there should be burns, all right? Who knows, right? And I'll just say.
Oh, burns, like RFK.
Right? And the powder would be embedded so that it wouldn't clean up Now, it doesn't look like an exit wound. You would think an exit wound would be 4 inches wide. So right. I don't know.
Looks like it was more of at a distance, John, actually, I would say.
That's an interesting observation. The point is, you have to do an autopsy, don't you? Right. If the gun was held far enough away that it didn't leave powder burns, it clearly wasn't held by Gary, which is why
we're almost out of time. But are you telling me that no autopsy was done on Gary?
No, you're looking at it.
That body.
This is 5 days after Gary was murdered. No autopsy.
Wow.
No, which is why Cyril Wecht was willing to do it, and why he was willing to do it for 5,000 instead of 10.
But what happened? How did that become aborted?
Mike Rupert and a bunch of other police agents descended upon the family and said, "You better burn the damn body." And the family said, "Oh shit, yeah,
burn the body."
They cremated it, and Gary's.
Wait a minute. Why would
No, let me talk. Gary's wife, because we're running out of time. Gary's wife called me up to apologize, and she said, "You know, I told you you could do an autopsy, but we cremated the body, and I'm really sorry that we did that without asking or telling or." And so on. And I said, "Lady, you don't have to apologize. I totally get it. The life is for the living. You felt threatened, and so you did it. And in any case, if Wecht had done the autopsy, all that he could have told us was that Gary was murdered. He couldn't tell us who. But the fact that there was no autopsy and a two-headshot suicide tells us who. We didn't need to do the autopsy. We know who killed him. The people, somebody killed him who could tell the coroner, no, you're not doing an autopsy."
It's called motive, means an opportunity, John, needless to say.
Well, and demonstration of power, right? I mean, you know, when Kennedy's body gets stolen, somebody who had the power to steal Kennedy's body had to have been involved. It wasn't the mafia because they didn't have the power to steal Kennedy's body. It wasn't the Russians or the Cubans because they didn't have the power to steal Kennedy's body. And the fact that Gary didn't get an autopsy tells you it was people who had the power to call up the coroner and say, nope, no autopsy necessary.
John, it was super having you here. We'll have to have you back. Gary, take us out.
Yeah, we didn't scratch the surface here, Jim, at all with this guy.
Yeah. All right. We could continue on another show. All right. This has been JFK number 104. And we appreciate John Hankey about this Gary Webb information. And we'll see everyone next week. We appreciate Chance George and Engineers Chair Larry Rivera, Dr. Fetzer, myself, and especially tonight. And we're looking forward to having Don Fox back pretty soon. And thank you again, John.
Thank you all for the opportunity. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Dr. James
Fetzer, have a great evening and a great life.
Larry Rivera,
see y'all later.
Number one researcher in the world today when it comes to new research. And we've got Don Fox, who's not afraid to look a little bit deeper than anyone else. So if you're interested in what happened to the 35th president of the United States, then I invite you to our show. It's called The New JFK Show, and it's on YouTube. Go to Gary King YouTube channel, and we've got over 90 shows archived for you there. So if you really want to know the truth, and knowing that over 9 out of 10 researchers are working the other side of the street in a sea of disinformation, I pledge to you the truth about JFK. Go to Gary King YouTube channel and find out your true history.